Hello everybody, this is English for You, the program that helps you improve your English. A very warm welcome. In the studio I have my enthusiastic, gifted, ever charming Fosse Fosse. Gato, what's happening?
Everything's fine.
Great. How are you doing, Sagar?
I'm fine, thanks.
Good. Victoria, what's up?
Everything's fine.
Good. How are you doing, Victor?
I'm great, thanks.
Good. Today's special guest is Mr. Andrew Wright, who is from England. Thank you very much for joining us. And you have brought along something very interesting
Lydia.
With you. Lydia?
Lydia, yes.
Do you always take Lydia with you, wherever you go?
Well, not wherever I go. But when I'm working with stories, then I usually take her.
Is it difficult to take her in your car, for example?
The car is the least of the problem, because, you know, I can put the safety belt on her. And actually, it's the only way of making policemen smile.
Good. Thank you very much. Now, Andrew has been doing a lot of things, and this is one of his sides, this picture. And I would like you, Cotta, would you say something about this picture?
Sure. This is a portrait of a little boy, and I think you might have painted it. Surely, yeah. And this boy is looking very serious, and it might be a self-portrait when...
Very good. That was my guess, too. Andrew, thank you, Cotta. Over to you. So what's the story with this picture?
Not a self-portrait. He was a boy in the school where I was in secondary school in Sheffield. And I suppose he was probably 13 and I was probably 17. And we could invite one of the younger boys to sit in the corner of the studio, the art classroom, for us to paint. It's important for me, this picture, because it was the very first oil painting that I ever did.
Congratulations. Now, you're a painter, aren't you?
I'm no longer a painter. Book illustrator, you could say.
Right. And I have something else. This is a book, a very serious book. Uh-huh. Pictures for Learning, for Language Learning for Teachers. Mm. And it's about visual images, how teachers can exploit visual images in the classroom. So you're a teacher trainer as well. And an author of very serious books like this?
Well, I don't know how serious it is. But yes, I write and illustrate.
Yeah. Here's another thing we might talk about, and this is a story for kids, little children, and I can see written and illustrated by Andrew Wright.
Yes.
So stories?
It's one story about Wilf. And Wilf is a little toy dog. If you just open the first page there.
Right, I'm going to do that. Here we go.
There we are. And there's Wilf. And I've got Wilf here.
Right?
There we are. Well, there's Wilf.
And you found Wilf somewhere?
I found Wilf on the beach in Whitby, in England. And he'd got this old shirt on when I found him, and he was being rolled up by the water and then pulled down again, and I took the water out of him.
And you wrote a book?
And
you wrote
made a story. Book about him.
Right. And I read it somewhere. In recent years, Andrew has worked with about 25,000 students as a storyteller and story maker. Storyteller. Now, this word sounds a little bit anachronistic, out of date, because I can well imagine Homer surrounded by people telling the story of the Iliad and the Odyssey. Or I can imagine storytellers belonging to the countryside during those long winter nights when women are shelling corn and there's a storyteller entertaining them.
Yes.
But modern day, we are here in the 21st century.
Yes.
Do we need storytellers?
We haven't changed as people. And we need stories as much as we ever did. And there are plenty of storytellers around.
I have this word, which is spin doctor, and I'm turning to my students. Have you ever heard about this phrase? No? So are you a spin doctor? First of all, what are spin doctors?
Well, I'm not a spin doctor. Spin doctors are story makers, and they are employed by politicians usually, And they're employed to find good stories about their employer and bad stories about the opposition. And so then they send these good stories and these bad stories to the newspapers and the television and so on.
So you're not a spin doctor?
No.
No, definitely not. Public relations officers or things like this, spin doctors, or not really?
They are spin doctors. They may sometimes be called public relations, but the royal family has one now. I mean, the royal family knows that it is a story, and it is a story anyway, very often not a very good story, and so they've employed a spin doctor to try to produce better stories about the royal family. It's a very serious business.
Thank you. Now, a couple of days I visited you in your house, and I somehow stole this. And you called this thing felt images. Why?
Well, the material is felt. In English we call it felt. I think in German it's filz. What is it in Hungarian?
Filz.
Oh, there we are. Okay, so it's the same.
So the material, pressed wool or something?
Yes, yes, that's right.
And the images are obvious.
Yes, and it's nice to call it felt images because it's made out of felt, but it's all to do with feelings.
So feel, felt, there we felt are. Images.
Yes.
Very good. Now, Andrew usually takes lots of visual images with him into the classroom, and I'm going to pose as if I were Andrew now, okay? Look at these images, please, and I would like you to look at this. Would you open this, Szabolcs?
Yes, for sure.
What do you think you will find in it?
Some kind of, gold or treasure.
Yes, and what if...
Expect something like this.
What if it's Pandora's box?
I don't know what would I found then.
So it's all, yes, would you, Kata, would you say?
They would find snakes.
Snakes, could be. And who do you think will find this treasure chest? Victoria?
The boy on the next picture.
What could you say about this boy?
He's poor, but clever. Maybe he's one of the three sons of an older man.
And youngest son, middle son, or the eldest son?
Youngest.
Obviously the youngest. What a stupid question it was. And who do you think lives in this tower or castle?
The princess.
Uh-huh. And what about this?
That's the dragon. Wants to eat the princess. Forget her somehow.
And just last question. Oh, yes. And what about this, the princess? And what about this?
That's a flower, and on this, the young boy can climb into, he can meet the princess.
Excellent.
Into the tower.
Thank you very much. Andrew, how do you like this?
I love to see you working away with this picture, which I've used before. But yes, each of these pictures is very symbolic, isn't it? It represents all kinds of things. In this case, from the past, but it could equally well be the present time.
Right. And also you have brought along your treasure bag.
Yes, this is one way of helping people to make stories using pictures. And that's what I use Lydia for. Here, you see, these are her tattoos. And I show her to the students, and the students begin to interpret the pictures. You know, perhaps she's got the sun there because... Why? Because...
Well, perhaps for her hair is made of sunshine.
Oh, lovely. Nice idea, yes. So this is one way of starting pictures going, and I've got a special coat here. This is my storyteller's coat. It's beautiful, isn't it?
It is.
Yes. A storyteller's coat or a story maker's coat, because the students can take characters, people, from the coat, and then I can say, where is that person at the moment? And they can look around and choose one of the pictures and slowly build up the story. So that's one of the ways of helping people to make stories.
Right. Has anything happened to you today that stirred up emotion in you or caused any problem? Victoria.
So I was traveling on the metro again as every day, but a little bit later than usual. And I wasn't expecting this kind of crowd I met. So first I had to miss two metros because I just couldn't get on. And I was really determined to get onto the third because I just had to go to school. And people were pushing me and they came really close. I wasn't feeling really good. And then, well, when I finally got into the metro, two people, well, a couple was necking in front of my face, and I was so close to them, I felt like a third person involved, and I just didn't want to take part in this.
Thank you. Would you call this a story seed?
Yes, because it's not a complete story, is it? It's interesting. It's got a real dilemma, real problem in it. You had the problem. They didn't have a problem, apparently. But it's not resolved. It's not brought to an end. It's not followed through. So I call this a story seed.
Can you come up with one story seed of yours?
Well, perhaps I could give you two, a very, very short one.
Okay.
And a longer one. I was working in a school in Italy. And during the coffee break, I saw that there was a chair near me in the classroom which had fallen over. Somebody had knocked it over. And I saw there was some writing on the bottom, and it said, Giorgio Emanuele died on this chair on the 14th of May, 1993. I thought that was a wonderful image. Now, that's a story seed. It's not a story. You know, you want to know more. But you do want to know more, and that's the secret of stories.
Right. Now, I would like you to tell us a nice story, a personal story, something that happened to you. And if you don't mind, I'm going to join my students.
Yes.
And I'm going to be the 25,005th student to listen to your stories.
I see what you mean, yes.
So over to you.
People often think that that really you've got to travel a lot and go to lots of countries, have lots of adventures in order to be a storyteller. But I'd like to tell you a story about our cat at home. I live at the moment in Gödöllő, so very nearby. You're hungry, you're lovely hungry. And I'm going to tell you a story about a Hungarian cat. And it was just a year ago, and the snow was on the ground like it is now. It was actually in the January. The snow was on the ground was hard. And I saw a little Kormi go out of the back door into the back garden. I saw her putting her warm paws into the snow and taking them out and flicking them because they were cold. And slowly she walked down the garden. It's very beautiful to see a black cat against the white snow of the garden. And so she disappeared. And she didn't come back in the afternoon and she didn't come back in the evening. That's what cats do. But the next morning, I put out her breakfast on a tin plate on the terrace. And usually when she hears the plate touch the terrace, then she comes running. But she didn't come. And the breakfast was there all morning and all afternoon and all evening. And it was there the next morning. So I began to get a bit worried. But our two little girls at home, my two daughters, Timmy and Alexandra, they don't know about road accidents to cats so much. I said, look, we better go and look for Kormi. Put all your winter clothes on. So you know what you have to do with little children. You build them up with huge thicknesses of winter suits and so on, woolly hats. Went into the garden and they called for her. Kormi, Kormi. No Kormi. I said, we better look around the district. Go down the roads and so on. I didn't want them to look at the road. So I told them to call into the gardens. Kormi, Kormi. But we didn't find her. And we went back home. And then the days went by. Four, that was the third day. Four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10 days went by. And then one Saturday morning we were at home in the sitting room and we heard her outside, this little meow. We ran outside and she was there on the terrace. And her front two legs were strong, but she was dragging her back legs and her tail on the ground. And her fur was full of snow and ice and mud, and she was shivering. Perhaps I could do a picture of her for you. tail and a back leg. Back legs there. And she was shivering. So, of course, I picked her up very carefully and took her into the sitting room again and put her on the sofa. I think the girls, you know, stroked her and gave her milk and so on. And then Julia, my wife Julia, phoned the animal doctor, the vet. And the vet came, and the first thing she did was to look into her eyes, and then into her ears. And then she felt her neck, and then she felt her back, and then at last she began to feel her legs and tail. And then she stopped and she turned to us and said, "That's very strange. There's nothing broken. I don't understand. Can you pay if we go to the animal hospital?" "Of course." So we went to the animal hospital and they put Cormy onto a table. They put her onto a table underneath a camera. And they made an X-ray, an X-ray photograph. We could see her bones. And we could see that between two of the bones there was a bullet. I wonder if you can see that. There was a bullet. Somebody had shot our cat. A neighbour. Whenever I walk down the street, even now, I look into my neighbour's eyes or in people in the street there. Men, women, boys, girls, younger, old, I don't know. Somebody shot the cat. The doctor said she can never walk again properly. She might live. The best thing we can do is put her to sleep, is to kill her. Should I do that? And I said, "Well, wait a minute. She's been coming home for 10 days and nights. What did she do when she met a dog or a cat or a rat? What did she do when she came to a wall? When a cat is strong, it can run up a wall. What did she do? Did she reach up and pull herself onto the wall with a bullet in her back and then jump down on the other side with a bullet in her back?" And all the time in that little cat's brain of hers, in her cat language, she was saying, "I must get home. I must get home. 10 days and nights. Are we going to kill her now?" I said, "If she drags her legs on the ground, what will happen?" The doctor said, "Well, her fur will come off." I thought, "Well, perhaps I could make a little pair of leather trousers like those men wear in the Tyrol. Perhaps I can use the blue, it might be a little bit stronger." Here we are, yes. And I can put a hole in the back to put her tail through. So I said, "No, don't kill her." And we took her home, and for a day or two she lay on the sofa and the children looked after her. And then one day Timmy called out, "Everybody come here quickly. Cormy's trying to stand up." And Cormy did try to stand up. She stood up and she tottered for a moment and fell over, and she tried again until she could stand up. And then she tried until she could walk and even trot a little bit. And then when the spring weather came, we took her into the garden so she could walk and trot there. She never learned to be able to jump again or to climb trees. But last summer, she had three babies, three kittens, with a bullet in her back.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your story. I mean, it's so difficult for me to say anything now. I would need some more silence, let's say, to keep silence for at least one or two more minutes. so wonderful. What is the secret of storytelling?
Well, I'm glad you're only giving me 1 minute, because I wouldn't be qualified if you gave me longer than that to say very much. I wish I knew. Two things that I think are very important. You can be a good storyteller, but still lose people. It's the right moment that you have to choose. You know, if people are hungry, for example, or they want to go somewhere else, they're not going to listen properly. So you've got to choose the right moment to tell a story. And the other thing, if I had to pick out something in the next 30 seconds, it would be your voice. That's more important, really, than anything else, the way you use your voice. So you might say, we've got a little cat at home. Its name is Cormie. Last winter it was very cold. She went for a walk. That's just how you can use your voice. But it's just a repetition of the same feeling, and then you lose people. So it's very important to use your voice with all the feelings and expression that you can give to it.
Would you encourage teachers to tell stories? Because I have a fear that they might be, I mean, the students might be a little passive. I mean, the teacher just stands there and tells the story, and the students just do nothing. You agree with that?
Well, I don't agree with it. In any case, teachers can give them activities to do, can't they? For example, that they could rewrite the story from the point of view of one of the protagonists, or the teacher could ask the participants to write letters to each other as if they were protagonists. Lots of activities they can do. But when you listen to a story, when you listen to the story about Cormie just then, you were doing something with it. Each of you was responding to it, I imagine, in a different kind of way. You might be thinking of your own cat, for example.
You don't mind if I interrupt you now, but I would like to ask you, which is the bit you most vividly remember of Andrew's story? To me, it's the white snow with the black cat. So it's a picture.
Right at the beginning.
It's just at the beginning of the story. Kato,
you just have the same thing.
The same thing, Saboj? Mm-hmm.
When we imagine that the cat is climbing on the fences.
Yes.
And the gates.
Yeah. That's the point. A strong image for you.
Yes.
Victoria?
The walls, as well as Saboj.
And Victor?
When he tried to stand up.
Yes. Okay. Yes. So, you see, they have been working at the people.
So they weren't passive?
No, you can't be.
Right.
In the face of a story like that.
Right. What do you think it means? And this is going to be our last phrase for today. First of all, help me say this.
And FOF.
FOF stories. And it's an acronym, isn't it?
Yes.
FOF. No idea. Dead silence. So, Andrew.
Friend of a friend. There are certain kinds of story which are always told as being true, but then you don't know if they really are or not. And the people begin by saying, a friend of a friend of mine told me an amazing story, or something of that kind, or my uncle's neighbor, or whoever it might be.
And do you think these stories are true stories or just invented stories, or it doesn't matter?
And I really don't know. If they don't sound possible, they're not really very attractive, and people don't keep on retelling them. So they've got to sound possible. Should I tell you?
Yes, I think we have 1 minute for a friend of a friend story.
1 minute. A Manchester family that I know went to Australia. They hired a car for the holiday, and they were driving across the desert when a great kangaroo came bounding across the desert into the front of the car, over the top, onto the road. The driver saw it lying on the road. They got out, went back to the kangaroo. Now the man, bit of a joker, he took his jacket off, and he managed to put it on the kangaroo. And then he picked up the kangaroo and he said to his wife, quick, take a photograph. He thought it was funny. But the kangaroo wasn't dead. It was just a little bit unconscious. And it raised its head, and then it blinked, and then it jumped away across the desert, wearing the man's jacket.
Yeah.
And he got his car keys in it.
And everything.
Air tickets. And somewhere in Australia.
Thank you very much for this lovely story. It's been a pleasure having you on the program. Thank you, Andrew, and see you next week, guys. It's going to be English for you again. Bye-bye.